The Andes is the largest continental mountain range in the world, running 4,500 miles long and 311 miles wide. It stretches 7 countries across South America, including Argentina, Bolivia, Chile, and Peru. At its highest peak, it boasts an altitude of 22,821 feet. The terrain ranges from lush, impenetrable forests down to sandy desert dunes. It even hosts a line of active volcanoes, as well as snow-capped mountains that rival that of the Himalayas. These mountains are covered in snow almost daily throughout the winter season, the average nightly temperatures dropping to negative 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and winds to match those of a cyclone. How did anyone survive in these conditions with no supplies, no preparation, and no training? Well, we're about to find out. I'm your host, Michael, and this is Strange and Unexplained. You know, the locals have a saying that interprets the veracity of the mountains that is the Andes. They say, what the Andes takes, it never gives back. Well, apparently everyone forgot to tell that to the passengers of Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571. Although they lost many people in their 72-day stay in the uninhabitable climate, they were able to miraculously hike out and rescue themselves, completely unprepared, providing us with the inspiring tale of making the impossible possible in the most unimaginable conditions. It all starts Friday, October 13th, 1972. Yeah, Friday the 13th, that's right. When the small chartered plane carrying 45 people took off from Uruguay to Chile for a rugby match. Most of those on board were members of the Old Christian Club rugby union team between the ages of 18 and 25 years old. And they were in their first or second year of college, and the rest were friends and family of theirs. As the passengers were settling into the plane, they jokingly spoke of how it was unlucky to be taken off on Friday the 13th. But these were religious men, and not superstitious men, so it really didn't bother them. Little did they know, they were foreshadowing their own story. And I do realize that by saying that, I foreshadowed my own story. But anyways, the flight took off in Uruguay, but had to make a stop just hours short of their destination in Argentina due to weather. After pressure from the passengers, the plane took off again around 2 p.m., which appears to be the first of several mistakes made in this situation. Flying over the Andes is apparently a very dangerous feat, even on a good day. More experienced pilots know to fly over the mountains in the morning hours, because if they wait till later in the day, the winds in the pass get unpredictable and extremely dangerous. Due to the amount of cold and hot air mixing late in the day, the winds in the area become cyclone-like and are almost impossible to fly in. But the pilot made a plan to head southwest on a longer but safer route. This route would lead them around the clouds, flying through the Andes in the Pass of Planchon. The pass dipped low and was wide enough that it would allow for the plane to navigate through the mountain range. Apparently, the aging plane could not reach the altitudes needed to just fly over the mountain pass, and this was their only alternative. As they neared the pass, the pilot could not see, and in making an estimate about their location, he radioed the tower and got permission to drop down to 10,000 feet and started his descent. But he actually ended up dropping to 3,000 feet in order to clear the clouds. That shouldn't make a big difference, right? What's 7,000 feet? What could possibly be in a range of 10,000 to 3,000 feet? Can't think of anything right now. As the clouds started to clear, it also became clear to the pilot that he had just made a grave miscalculation. Instead of emerging to see the pass and green valleys, clear and wide enough to fly through, the clouds peeled back, and the pilot realized he was staring straight into the side of a mountain. He hastily threw on the fasten seatbelt sign, and the cab that was once full of laughter and rough housing quickly turned to quiet prayers, comforting whispers, and worried sobs as the turbulence worsened. One of the men recalls laughing and joking with another friend when his teammate that was sitting next to the window elbowed him and said, "Hey, are we supposed to be flying this close to the mountains?" He looked out, and just a few meters from the wing were the jagged, sharp, desolate mountaintops of the Andes. the passengers were unaware of their plight at this time. And he said, yeah, it's no big deal. It's perspective making them look closer. But back in the cockpit, the pilots make another crucial mistake. In an attempt to pull out of the mountains and try to avoid impact, the pilot makes a sudden attempt to pull up and gain altitude quickly. And instead of climbing up, the plane suddenly stalled, sending it down into the face of the mountain. First off, what a piece of shit aircraft. You're flying something over mountain ranges that is not even able to reach the altitude of the mountains, or at least not quickly enough. That makes no sense. Why you would even charter this many people. I mean, it is 1972, I guess. Okay. Excuse me. Okay. So there was a sudden metallic sound. Then impact. It was accompanied by the freezing, blistering winds hitting them all in the face. The plane's right wing is ripped off while it flies back and hits the tail, exposing the passengers to the outside elements and sucking five of the seats off the floor, killing two members of the crew and three passengers immediately. One survivor talks of hearing a teammate scream about how he was blind. And when he turned to see who was screaming, he saw the man's brain hanging out the side of his skull, and he had a stick through his abdomen. Nando Parada, a survivor who would eventually step into a leadership role for the group, switched seats with a teammate just minutes before the crash. The other boy didn't make it, as a piece of the propeller ripped through the body of the plane, killing him, and Nando was knocked unconscious and sent into a coma for the next 4 days, but he would eventually recover. Nando's mother and sister had also been with him on the plane. His mother passed away during the crash. She was crushed to death. And his sister, who was bleeding out from a head injury, would die in his arms the day after he awoke from his coma. The plane hits another mountain peak, belly side, ripping off the left wing and sending it up into the air again, over a ravine and onto the side of the adjoining mountain. They actually got lucky here, believe it or not. If they land basically any other way, the entire population of the plane is done. But the way this plane hit, it almost hit while sliding up a ramp. And with the velocity of the plane, it went up the ramp, off, over a ravine, and then down a downward sloped mountain. Okay, so it's almost perfect. If you think of like a tabletop ramp for a skateboarder or dirt bike, you see these a lot with dirt bikes, these huge tabletops where they'll jump and then the landing is easy because it's at the same angle at which they're coming down. This kind of happened for the plane, and it was, I hate to say a blessing in a terrible time like this, but it was the only good thing that happened to them. Okay, let's put it that way. So, the plane, with only the fuselage and the cockpit still somewhat intact, is sent sliding down the side of the mountain like a bobsled. What was left of the large metallic tube came to a rest in a valley, completely surrounded by rocky, snow-covered mountains on every side, at an altitude of 11,800 feet above sea level. Nightly temperatures in that particular area dropped to negative 20 degrees Fahrenheit, like I said in the beginning. Once the nightmare of the crash ends, Robert Canessa, who would become one of the heroes of this tale, was a newly practicing medical student with all of 6 months of training under his belt. He simply says, "It has stopped. I'm alive." And then he faints. Once he regains consciousness and is able to get free of his seatbelt restraints, he heads towards what is the tail of the plane, but is now just a giant opening. He emerges from the plane and witnesses the magnificence and terror of what just happened and the severity of the situation. There are no trees, there are no grass, no sounds, other than the screaming injured, of course. There is nothing here. Where is here? They had literally just fallen out of the sky in an inhospitable environment, and they were completely on their own. No emergency service would drive up. No first responders or firemen, no bystanders or witnesses, no one and nothing. That is what the survivors of Uruguayan Flight 571 were faced with. It was imperative they jump into action quickly. One of the original 45 on board, 5 being crew members and 40 being passengers, 12 died in the initial crash, including the pilot. One of the pilots survived, but died hours later from his injuries, which were caused by the instrument panel being lodged against his chest, crushing and trapping him. When the other survivors found him, he asked only for water and his revolver. They fed the pilot snow, but chose not to be a part of his suicide and denied him his revolver. He had also told the group that they had just passed Corico, which was where the mistake was made. Instead of being near Corico, the plane was several miles northeast of Corico. And this may not seem like a big deal, except for the fact that the pilot, before his death, decided to pass on information to the survivors, right? Telling them that they had just passed Corico, which was not true. So they really had no idea where they were. The pilot thought he had flown over the Andes and then turned north after he cleared them, headed towards Santiago, Chile. But he had actually turned north in the middle of the Andes, putting them descending right into what they were trying to avoid. 33 people survived the crash, but they had injuries now, ranging from scratches and bruises to horrible life-threatening conditions. The plane had stopped, but this story, the story of how some of these people made it off that mountain, was just beginning. Marcelo Perez was the captain of the rugby team and just 25 years old. He quickly took leadership of this group. Robert Conesa, along with the first-year medical student Gustavo Zarpino, both just 19, started assessing injuries and doing what they could to help. But in the middle of nowhere, it's hard to help people who are injured so severely. With bones exposed and entrails showing outwardly, the only thing these boys could do was attempt to wrap wounds with t-shirts and anything else they could find. Which wasn't much, considering most of them had packed for a vacation, not a life-threatening snowy mountain expedition. Most of them had been dressed in shorts, long socks, cleats, with light sweaters on. They started layering any clothing that they could find. They had no emergency supplies, minimal training, and the ones treating the wounded just went through the same traumatizing experiences as the people they were trying to help. These men did all they could to help those who were left and comfort those who they could do nothing for. Gustavo Zarpino told how he pulled a rod out of a fellow team member's abdomen by pulling the old, what's that over there trick. And when he looks away, Gustavo swiftly places his knee against the man's body and yanks the rod out, pulling some of his intestines out too. Gustavo then tosses him a shirt and says to wrap it up and get back to helping the others. And he does. The guy tucks his insides back in, ties a shirt around his wound, then proceeds to help the others. God damn, rugby players are tough as hell. Either that or they in shock. Everyone was running on adrenaline, and it seemed like everyone left had a very strong will to live. One woman had been launched forward and buried under a rows of seats, crushing both of her legs and pinning her with the others unable to help. When the plane crashed, it was late afternoon, and the group knew that a rescue this late in the day in this terrain would be nearly impossible. So the group tried to prepare to spend the night in what was left of the plane. Knowing that the harsh environment would only get worse when the sun went down, some of the group attempted to build a wall in the back of the plane to keep the wind and cold out. They used seats and suitcases to stack in the hole left by the plane's ripped-off tail. The tail, which held all of the plane's batteries, which meant that the radio and everything on the plane was useless. The first night in the mountain was the worst, Canessa recalls. Quote, I don't know if Dante's Inferno exists, but if it does, it was that night in the fuselage on that mountain. End quote. The remaining survivors, all injured to some degree, not only had to deal with the severity of what just happened, along with the sub-zero temperatures and blistering winds that seemed to scream themselves throughout the metal compartment, they also had to listen to the screams of those dying while surrounded by the bodies of those they had just lost. Grazielia Magnani, the woman who had both legs trapped and was pinned, had bought her ticket last minute to attend her daughter's wedding. She was, at this point, slipping into a delusional state, and in a state of shock, she began to scream about how the group was trying to kill her. Quote, "May God forgive you all for not helping me. I'm dying. Please help me. Oh God, please make it stop. Please, God," she cried, begging for the end to come, begging for the pain to stop, begging for help, and the only ears that these cries fell upon were that of the group that could do nothing but sit and wait. She died later that night, along with four others. By October 14th, only 28 of the 45 who left Uruguay were still alive, trapped and completely secluded from the rest of the world. When the sun rose that morning, it was a somber but relieving feeling for the survivors. With its arrival, it brought warmth and light, but it also reminded the survivors that what had occurred the evening before was not a mere nightmare, as they had hoped, but it was indeed their new reality. Enduring and surviving such a disaster in itself is a miracle. But the real miracle of this tale is what happened after the crash. How this group survived the unsurvivable, climbed the unclimbable, how they did the impossible, and the measures they went to live. The crash, it was just the beginning. All right, guys, so that concludes part one of Uruguayan Flight 571. I hope you guys have enjoyed that. There's still so much left of this story. And believe it or not, it actually leaves you with a somewhat of a good feeling at the end. After all of this death and all these unfortunate events that led to this tragedy. So you guys stay tuned for that. Part two will be released on Patreon next Thursday, of course, like always. And, you know, you freeloaders will have to wait till next Monday. That's how it is. But speaking of people who are not freeloaders, I want to give a big thanks to Chubbs Geiselman for signing up on Patreon this week. Thank you so much. Signed on at the $5 tier. So, Chubbs, you'll be receiving your Patreon exclusive Strange and Unexplained sticker in the mail very soon. Thank you so much for your support. I appreciate that very much, guys. And I'm also looking to add more content to that $5 tier here very soon. Also, I don't know if some of you noticed, I added a few sound effects, a few musical interludes and whatnot into this episode. I felt like it needed it. Of course, there's no Lorne Synopsis this week. So don't worry. I mean, I guess I could play the song for you guys if you still want to hear the song. But no, I'm just kidding. Guys, I'll play the song next week, I promise, when Lauren is back with a synopsis about this entire case. Not that it's like a mystery or anything. It's just an amazing feat that is incredibly strange and to a lot of people unexplained, including myself when I found it. So that's why I figured it would be such a great case. And, you know, I don't want to cover all downers all the time. You guys know that. I gotta bring some levity to this whole show, to this whole podcast. Some cases don't allow for it. And other cases do. And other cases have a little bit of both, like this one. So I'm very excited to bring you guys part two next week. So stay tuned for that. Like I said, if you want to hear part two a little earlier, if you want to hear it on Thursday, patreon.com/SandUPodcast. Part two will be up on Thursday. That's patreon.com/SandUPodcast for just $3 a month. You guys can get early access to all of these episodes, as well as access to Strange Shorts, another show that I do just on Patreon, and it will be released on Mondays as well. All right, so guys, if you can't join Patreon, no sweat. Maybe you're already a patron for True Crime Guys and you're like, Jesus, I'm not giving all my money to TCG Productions. I get it. There's a lot of freaking streaming services out there. There's a lot of monthly bills going on. That's fine. But if you could help me out by leaving a review or following me on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, preferably Instagram. Instagram is where most things go down. I try to stay up to date on there. A lot of my posts on Facebook and Twitter, if I'm being honest, with True Crime Guys and Sandu, a lot of those are what do you call them? Pre-scheduled post. So the RSS feed platform sends those posts out. But on Instagram, it is not that. It is not so. I personally make almost every post on Instagram, either myself or Lauren. We do not have someone managing our social media at this time. That is something we're kind of looking into. At least I am, for sure. But of course, that's a tough process, right? It's tough to find a person who understands your brand and what you're trying to portray, right, on social media, because your presence on social media is a big part of who you are, period. Whether it's a show or you as a person, whatever it is, that's the world we live in, okay? Most people know you by who you are on social media. So social media is extremely important, right? But with that said, guys, go give me a follow, give me a like. You can send a case suggestion at S&U Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, or Strange and Unexplained on Facebook if you prefer. But like I said, Instagram is my bread and butter. That's where I like to go to. Everybody likes pictures. Some people don't like to read. We like to listen to podcasts, right? Come on. It just fits. Instagram and podcast, it's perfect. You get the visual, you get the audio, you get both. But guys, I appreciate any way you help the show, okay? Another great way to help the show is get some merch, truecrimeguys.threadless.com. We have tons of different designs there available for you. There's definitely something that you'll like, from hoodies to sweatshirts, t-shirts, tank tops. There's all kinds of stuff, stickers, mouse pads, mugs, travel mugs, whatever you want, okay? Water bottles, notebooks. It's there, okay? That's truecrimeguys.threadless.com. We also have other merch sites available. Redbubble, you can search True Crime Guys. There are designs on there as well. So if you're a True Crime Guys Productions fan, any of those merch sites, and you should be able to find something that you like. There's also different designs on all of our merch sites as well. Threadless, Ken Custom, and also Redbubble. So any of those sites, there are links to them in the description of every True Crime Guys episode, and I put a link to the Threadless one in every Strange and Unexplained episode, because that's where my Strange and Unexplained designs are at. Doesn't that make sense? All right, guys. Well, I want to thank you for listening, as always. Thank you so much. And please stay tuned. Share this part one with someone, and hopefully they will be excited about part two as well. Don't get overexcited and go Googling the rest of this case, okay? Just wait. Let me bring it to you. It'll be next week. Just hang on. All right, guys. Thank you so much. And remember, be strange. Just don't be strangers out there.